Hello, and welcome to another Little Atoms road trip podcast. I'm in a place called Glen Ellen in the wine country of Northern California, and I'm about to talk to Bernie Krause. Bernie Krause is both a musician and a naturalist. A former member of seminal folk band The Weavers, he replaced Pete Seeger as the guitarist. Krause became a pioneer of electronic music, studying at Mills College under Karlheinz Stockhausen and Pauline Oliveros, and later popularising the Moog synthesizer. As part of the duo Beaver and Krause, he worked on the soundtrack to many iconic 70s films, such as Apocalypse Now, Rosemary's Baby, and Performance. For more than 40 years, Krause has travelled the world, recording and archiving the sounds of creatures and environments, large and small. He has recorded more than 15,000 species and 4,000 hours of wild soundscapes, over half of which no longer exist in nature due to encroaching noise and human activity. Bernie is the author of The Great Animal Orchestra, which we talk about in this interview. And inspired by Bernie, I've liberally sprinkled some recorded wild soundscapes throughout this interview. These were recorded at night on the Walnut Farm belonging to the great anthropologist Sarah Hurdy in a place called Winters, California. And you can hear cicadas and bullfrogs and wild turkeys and peacocks and lots of other birds. I'm talking to Bernie Krause. Bernie, thank you very much for talking to me today.
My pleasure, Neil.
We're going to be talking about, in the main, your book, The Great Animal Orchestra. But let's talk about your background first and how you came to be studying soundscapes in the first place.
Well, my background's in music, and largely I'm in sound because I don't see very well. And so my world is pretty much informed by acoustics. And I began pretty much as a classical violinist and composer, switched to guitar when I was 13, I guess. I guess the hormones kicked in and, it was guitar time. And when I learned all styles of guitar, I knew jazz and classical and some of the pop styles as well, and kind of worked my way through University of Michigan, occasionally playing guitar for Motown. So I drove the 30 miles from Ann Arbor to Detroit to work at Motown while I was in school, because I couldn't get into any music school in the United States in 1955 because guitar wasn't considered a musical instrument. I mean, if you believe that. I had 300 years of classical music, guitar music under my arm when I went in to do my juries, but it didn't matter. Anyway, I finished school and joined a folk group called The Weavers, ostensibly covering the Pete Seeger chair in The Weavers and introducing a song at our Carnegie Hall concert in 1963 called Guantanamera. Mm-hmm. And after The Weavers broke up, I came out to California to work and learn electronic music at Mills. Mills College had one of the kind of leading electronic music programs and tape music programs at the time. This was 1965, and Karlheinz Stockhausen was lecturing and teaching, and so was Pauline Oliveros, a famous avant-garde American composer. And they kind of got me interested in the whole field, but it wasn't until I met my music partner, Paul Beaver, from Los Angeles, a guy who was older than me and had quite a bit of experience with Hammond organ and using Hammond Nova chords and weird instruments that he used for kind of B-movies in Hollywood, Creature from the Black Lagoon and so on. And he did all the weird effects. And he had one of the original Leon theremins, mm-hmm. The tube device that he played and used on many of these films. Well, Paul and I formed a team called Beaver and Krause, and we did an album for Nonesuch called The Nonesuch Guide to Electronic Music, mm-hmm. which was really the first guide that really explained what was going on with analog synthesis. And it's still a standard reference today. And one of the first albums that we did for Warner Brothers in the late 1960s, it didn't come out until 1970, but the album that we did called In a Wild Sanctuary was the first album on the theme of ecology, and also the first album ever to use natural soundscapes mm-hmm. as a component of orchestration. And Paul didn't like to record outside. He really preferred being inside in the safety of the studio and the four walls of a studio. To me, I find that very oppressive. And I wanted to be outside where things were a little bit more uncertain. And so I went to the field with the first stereo system that I had seen for field work and began to record. And the first time I turned on the recorder north of San Francisco, it was an epiphany for me. It changed my life.
Let's define what a soundscape is then.
Well, a soundscape is a word that just found its way into the lexicon. And it was introduced by R. Murray Schafer, a Canadian composer, who had heard the word before, but it wasn't defined in any particular way. And in his 1977 book, Tuning of the World, he really put meat on the bones of the idea of the soundscape. And typically, what the soundscape means is all the sound that reaches our ears at any given time from any habitat and from all sources. The problem with his definition was, I mean, it really wasn't a problem, his definition, but one of the things that was missing from his definition was an identification of those sources. And so I took the anatomy of the soundscape, tried to describe it in more detail, and applied the word biophony, which bio meaning life, and phone from Greek meaning sound, so the sounds of living organisms. Geophony, the sounds of the natural sounds of the world that are non-biological, like wind and rain and water. And anthropony, human noise. So with those three terms, we're able to really kind of fold out what's happening in detail, in more detail, what's going on in the larger landscape as far as sources of sound are concerned.
Traditionally, the people who record the natural world tend to record one source, for instance, birdsong. People would record one birdsong.
Yeah.
So this was a new thing. This was a new method.
Yeah. The old scientific method of the 19th century was to kind of separate things out of the natural world, take them out of context, mm-hmm. to study them.
Categorize them.
Yeah, the old Linnaean idea of looking at the world, which is fine. I mean, it's one way of looking at it. But the problem was that, you know, these birds and mammals and frogs and reptiles and amphibians are all vocalizing in a context and in relationship to one another, either competitive or cooperative, in a way that really defines the soundscape. The soundscape, in that sense, and the biophony in the natural world, is a narrative of place. And that narrative contains a lot of information that we're just beginning to figure out now, very late in the game, because these habitats are disappearing at an extremely rapid rate. I mean, in my library, I've got 4,500 hours in my library, and probably 50% of my archive is from habitats that are now silent. Speaking of silent spring, and it's going very fast, that's in 44 years. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to those three natural sound categories that you mentioned, and I'd like to go through them one at a time and perhaps talk about some of the different characteristics of recording them and different experiences you've had. So let's start with geophony then. Define again what that is, and then we can...
Well, geophony is the sounds of water, waves at the beach, water trickling in a stream, the effects of wind on the leaves and trees and grasses. It could be an earthquake or an avalanche. All natural sounds that are non-biological. And the sounds of water were the first sounds that were experienced by living organisms. So the geophony is very important in that regard. And that really pretty much makes up the definition of what the geophony is.
There's a fantastic image in the book, which is almost like the old adage of if a tree falls in the forest, is anyone there to make a sound? In that the earth was there for billions of years with earthquakes happening, volcanoes going off. With nobody to hear it, all of that colossal noise, with actually nobody to interpret those sounds.
Well, probably around 600 million years ago, there were organisms that actually detected the sounds. Oddly enough, off the coast of Newfoundland, and these organisms were very primitive, but they were noted to be the first that actually made sounds, so they had to fit somehow or other in that. They had to find bandwidth within the geophony to be able to be heard and survive, if sound was a component of their survival.
There's also another great scene in the book where you talk about recording beaches and the waves on beaches and how that's different. And this is a great story, which, again, most people would not realise that they sound different. So tell us about that experience of recording different beaches.
Well, I just happened to be... I like to record waves at beaches. And one of the things that I noticed as I travelled to many different spots was that the waves sound different at each beach. And I didn't really understand why. Well, some beaches are sandy and they have a very shallow rake, and some beaches are rocky and the fall off of the rake is really drastic, the angle of the rake. Well, all of these beaches, given pretty much the same weather, put out a different soundscape. And the rate at which the waves hit the beach, the power with which they hit the beach, all of these things go into making up that particular aspect of the soundscape. And it's pretty neat to notice that. I mean, the beach at Rio de Janeiro is very much different from the beach in East Anglia, in the North Sea.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that beach at Oldborough, so I was particularly pleased.
Rocky, and I've got a great recording of that. But what's happening is the waves and Aldborough are coming up on the beach very rapidly, and they're very shallow, so they come very fast. The beaches in Big Sur or here in the California coast are very slow and languid, and probably it's one of the reasons that it was named the Pacific Ocean, because of the sound of the beach that way.
Let's move on to the biophony. Let's look at biophony then, which is... I guess the vast majority of the sounds that you record, the sound of animals and plants. So let's talk about the wide variety of recordings that you've made.
Well, I've recorded everything from the Arctic to the equator, to the Antarctic. And one of the things that you notice about the biophony is much more dense at the equator, which makes sense, in the rainforests, because the rainforests have much more dense vegetation. They have many more food sources. They're more stable in terms of daylight and night. They're only 12 hours at the equator at all times of year. And the seasons aren't as radical, so the birds don't have to migrate. They're in a place that's much more stable. So the environment that they're in doesn't change over time as rapidly. One of the things that you notice is the creature density is much greater there, too. So if many creatures have to vocalize, they damn well better find a place in the spectrum where their voices can be heard. Otherwise, their voices will be masked and they won't thrive. So they find these complex ways in which they can vocalize and stay out of each other's way. And that bandwidth that they each find, from very low to very high, is really critical to how it is that they're going to thrive.
This is your theory and the main sort of thesis of the book, this idea that animals and plants and all sound-making things, or conscious sound-making things, take some evolutionary niche, I guess, is the way to describe it.
Well, it's not only that, but it's really interesting to see what happens in a tropical rainforest or subtropical rainforest. And during the course of the day, the animals enter the audio spectrum following the Darwinian timelines of evolution. What's happening is the insects around 2 o'clock in the morning will enter into the spectrum, first the insects, and then you'll hear reptiles come in, and amphibians, and then the birds, and then the mammals. And all of these things follow that structure that Darwin talked about. It's absolutely marvelous to see how that evolves and how it evolves every day. And then when you look at it, of course, as a spectrogram, which is a graphic display of the soundscape, the detail there that shows the discrimination between each of these voices is absolutely phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
It's both frequency-related and temporally related. So this bandwidth, covers both time and acoustic territory.
Thank you.
What's the function then of that, what you've just described in the, you know, the Darwinian time period of the different creatures emerging? What function does that perform, or is it just a coincidence?
I don't know if it's a coincidence. We don't know enough about sound because we're a visual culture. I mean, Western culture is just based on what we see pretty much. We haven't got language for sound. I mean, we have language for sound and music, but that defines a very narrow range of our experience of sound. But the sound in general, which is what I'm really interested in, is finding new language and new ways to experience the world that we live in from an acoustic perspective. So that's very important to me.
We should look at, again, just a bit more deeper into that theory. And you've just described there the animals filling the
niches,
those sort of niches of in a Darwinian way, but also just in terms of how they're enable to take a certain niche to enable communication between themselves. I mean, that sort of...
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, and that's how we got our music, of course, because the animals taught us to dance and sing. There are people who certainly not agree with me on that, because we're so solipsistic and kind of invested in our idea of being composers with a capital C, or artists with a capital A, or performers, or, you know, whatever it is the hell we are. It's always, we always have a big ego investment in that. And that's fine. I don't mind that, except that the natural world is telling us something different. And those people who live much more closely connected to the natural world, of course, use the sounds of forest around them, where there's no human interference other than their presence. They use the sounds of the forest around them as a natural karaoke orchestra with which they perform. And it's their backup band, you know, and there isn't a distinction between them and the natural world. There's no word in their lexicon like nature, it and us. There's no word in their lexicon for a musician. You know, they aren't musicians, but everybody is musical. Everybody's playing and singing. There is no word for artist. There's no word for any of this stuff, because there's no distinction between them and the natural world. They don't set it up that way like we do. Mm-hmm. And when they see that disappearing, they actually get physically ill, and they have to go into the forest, into the deep forest, disappearing for sometimes months at a time in order to heal and repair themselves psychically and physically and emotionally, because the din of the cash economy, you know, of the things that the French and the Chinese and the Brits and the Americans are bringing to the environment to extract resources makes a lot of noise, and that noise is having an effect on the health of these people who live very gently with the natural world.
There's another example of that in the book. Tell us the story of the waterfall.
Oh, Celilo Falls. Celilo Falls is a place that's about mid-river on the Columbia, which separates Washington State and Oregon in the northwest part of the United States. And Celilo Falls was a fishing site for a very small Native American group called the Wyam. And the Wyam fished there for centuries, small numbers of people, of course, but the falls, the noise of the falls, always informed them about spirituality, about all kinds of things related to their existence. And at one point in the mid-1950s, the Army Corps of Engineers put up a dam 8 miles downriver from where the Celilo Falls was, because they wanted people to be able to navigate the river more easily. And the level of the river came up and it swamped the falls. So the falls became silent. And the tribe, members of the tribe, this is 1957, and the members of the tribe began to drink, got heavily involved in alcohol. They had no fishing resources anymore. They used to fish, you know, they used to catch fish in a couple of weeks, and the fish would last them all year. You know, they would dry the fish and so on, but they couldn't do that anymore. So it changed the whole idea of the soundscape and the ways in which we've infected, and I use that term advisedly, the ways in which we've infected the world with our own egos, our own dominance, and our need to, you know, make an impression and leave a footprint. It's really had an impact.
I'd like to talk again about the ways in which other peoples use sound rather than visual cues. And you talked about the rainforest, and I guess one of the reasons for that is that, you know, the visual field is a lot shallower anyway, so it's in some ways it's easier. But there's a great example in the book about, you talk about Australian Aborigines basically giving directions by sound as well.
Yeah, when I did a short walk about one of the Pitjantjatjara, would describe, well, you walk some distance in that direction until you hear the green ants sing, and then you go in another direction, and so on. I wasn't very good at that because I didn't know what the hell they were talking about, but they knew what they were talking about because they live there and thrive there and do quite well, whereas we don't do so well there. But it's the same thing with people in the rainforests. The Hivaro, the Bayaka that we were talking about, who live in the Central African Republic, they navigate through the very dense rainforest at night using the natural soundscape, the biophony, as an oral GPS. They know exactly where they are by the ways in which the sound engages them. They can tell what animal is a quarter of a mile down the path of the forest, whether or not what direction it's heading in, whether it's worth a hunt and following, just by listening to the natural sound around them. It contains all of those cues. Mm-hmm. So imagine if we could figure out and decipher a little bit about what this narrative is. We might be able to find some resonance between ourselves and that world that we're pretty much lost.
Let's just look at an example of you being out in the field and recording a particular soundscape in a bit of detail. And you talk in the book about going to Diane Fossey's camp from where she was studying the mountain gorillas. And let's talk a little bit about that experience.
Well, Diane Fossey lived in a very remote area, and she chose that remote area, which was about 18 kilometers from the nearest small town, and up at the beginning of the trail to her camp was at 8,000 feet, and the end of the trail was at 10,000 feet. It was probably not more than a mile and a half, so it's a pretty steep climb. And she chose the ways in which she laid out the camp to be very inhospitable in many ways. The cabins were far apart, and there was a lot of mud between each cabin because it's a rainforest and it's on the mountainside, so that the people who worked there had to be able to live in an environment pretty isolated and not within easy contact of others who lived there. And many people, young researchers, went screaming out of the camp, totally pathological in terms of, their mental health after a while. It's pretty weird. And also you get there and you set up your gear. And this is just, I didn't really mind that stuff. I found it pretty interesting. But, if you were sitting here talking like you and I are sitting here talking, there'd be these forest rats. There'd be probably 10 of them on the table just running around or running around your bag or looking around. Same thing when you're eating. They're all over your food and stuff. So it makes for an interesting challenge to keep your sanity while working in a spot like that. But every day, the guides in camp would go out and search for the gorillas. I wasn't there when Diane Fossey was there. She had been killed 2 years before I got there exactly. They opened up the cabin on the second anniversary of her death, when the day after we got there for the first time, which was another story. But each day the guides would go out and search for the gorillas, and so that the researchers could find them. And they'd come back and they'd lead you to the vicinity of where they had seen them. And typically it was anywhere from a 1 to 5 mile march through very dense vegetation and levels of mountain that ranged anywhere from, 10,000 to 15,000 feet. So you had to be in pretty good shape to navigate this environment. When you got to the gorillas and there's a picture of me up there on the wall. I was just nesting down with them for the afternoon. And they usually take a siesta around midday, and they sleep for an hour. And I would just nest down with them. I didn't have any problem. I habituated pretty quickly. And found that the experience of working with them was magical. Because I grew up in an environment in the Midwest that was terrified of animals. We never had an animal in the house. A goldfish was dangerous. My parents just thought they were awful. So we never had a dog or a cat or a goldfish or anything else. And by the time when I first started doing natural sound, when I was already 30 years old, I was pretty terrified. I carried some of that impression with me for a long time until I learned that you could be quite safe as long as you were alert and aware of your surroundings. And sure enough, I ended up the second day or third day, I thought I knew everything I was supposed to know about gorillas, and I got between two males that were fighting over a female. What else? You know, and I got grabbed by one of the males and thrown out of the way, you know, 15 feet through the air with my, with 50 pounds of gear on me. It was memorable. Yeah, but I'm, well, he's all mine.
One of those moments where you realize as well just the strength of another creature as well, to bodily pick you up and throw you through the air.
Oh, one hand.
Yeah.
And it was a young one. I mean, just grabbed my shoulder, and I was 190 pounds of animal and machine, and I was airborne. I mean, it was, you know.
So the third category then of the sound category is the anthrophony, human-generated sounds.
Yeah.
And I guess I'd like to look at this in terms of noise pollution, really. So let's look at ways in which human beings have affected other soundscapes a little and what we can do about it, I guess.
There are a lot of studies being done by the EU countries on noise and noise pollution. In the US, almost nothing is being done because there was actually a guy who was Secretary of the Interior under Ronald Reagan, and he said at one point, his name was James Watt, and he said at one point, you know, noise is power. And the noisier we are as a country, the more powerful we appear to be to others. And we've kind of taken that to heart, you know, with straight piping motorcycles and ORVs and ATVs and all of the stuff that we take off road with us, you know, to try to assert our presence. And it's only asserted by noise and speed. This fellow who invented the word soundscape, R. Murray Schafer, suggested at one point, he said, you know, if it wasn't for the noise, the NASCAR races would probably normally draw 100,000 people, would probably draw not more than 5 or 10,000 if it wasn't for the noise.
If they raced in the electric cars driving around silently, yeah. That's
well, the electric, that's interesting because the Fisker Karma car that just came out last year, because it was so quiet, they actually introduced speakers in the front of the car that put out these combination Formula One and electronic sounds so that, you know, driving through your neighborhood, it's going to be a noisy one. So people would know that you're coming in a very expensive vehicle.
Bernie, thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been
my
pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure.
I'm Daleen Veland. That was a Little Adams Road Trip podcast. The show was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAdams, and thanks for listening.